Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with actor Jeff Plunkett, who is currently wowing them in his portrayal of Joseph Alsop in The Columnist at FST, Florida Studio Theater in Sarasota, Florida. Jeff is not only an extremely talented actor, he's a very interesting man. So this is a very interesting interview. Hang on, here come the show. Show is all about being the person you really are, so you can live the life you were meant to live. When I say this, I'm struck by the fact that this seems so ideal. So this is the way it should be. We should all be able to be the person we really are, and to be living the life we were meant to live. How could it be other? Why would we be living a life we were not meant to live? Why would we be being a person we weren't? And yet, as I say in every show, over and over again, I come in contact with, at my work, which is psychotherapy. I am a psychotherapist. And people come to me and they say things like, I always wanted to, I'd like to stop, I don't know why I'm doing this, and quite often, I don't know what I want, or even, I don't know who I am. Now, admittedly, this is a skewed sample. These are people who come to a therapist. But I believe, actually, that this is kind of epidemic, because I see it other places than in my practice. So how can this happen? How can we become someone we're not? Well, of course, we don't become someone we're not. We become someone who is acting as though we're not the person we are. We're pretending to be other than we are. And if you are pretending to be other than you are, it's really tough to be living the life you were meant to live. If you listen to this show, you've heard me say over and over again that I believe that early childhood dictates not who we are, but who we think it's okay to be. So that our families of origin, our school experience, our religious upbringing, the culture we were born into, and all kinds of other circumstances lead us to make decisions about what it is that it is safe for us to do, what it is that it is dangerous for us to expose or to risk. And once we've made that decision, and we make it quite young, and we make it on the basis of the experience that we had. So if you are a joyful, exuberant child, and you have parents who are frightened by that behavior, and they discourage it, and as we all know, parents have lots of ways of discouraging behavior, then you may very well learn to hide your exuberance and come to think of yourself as not a particularly joyful person. In so many of the interviews that I've done in the last few weeks, the remarkable impact of teachers on the ability of people to be who they really are based on what they learned from teachers. Fortunately, pretty much all of the people that I have interviewed in the last few weeks had teachers, for the most part, who encouraged them to be who they really are, who said, "Wow, that's great," or, "You really seem to like that." On the other hand, my mother tells the story of having sung in class in elementary school. My mother had a very big belt voice. Teacher didn't like it and said unkind things about it. And my mother essentially stopped singing, or she sang in a little voice from then on. So you can see that it doesn't take much to divert us from the path of who we are to a path of, let me pretend to be this because it's safer. I believe that the most satisfying life is the life you were meant to live, and you can only live that if you are able to be the person you really are. So, the Lynn Show is about my trying to encourage you to ask yourself, is there a quality you always wish you had? Is there a way of being that you see other people doing and you think, well, why can't I do that? Why can't I be spontaneous? Why am I running the litany of everything I want to say before I say it? Or why am I always taking up the slack of the conversation? Why am I always talking? Why can't I sit quiet? I see other people sitting quietly. They don't always need to be entertaining or diffusing. Why can't I do that? Or, God, I always wanted to go to graduate school. Why can't I do that? Other people do it. Well, maybe you can do it. Maybe it is you. Maybe that's a part of you which, like my mother, you needed to learn to hide so that you didn't have to be embarrassed or humiliated or teased or punished or abused. But that quality, whatever it is, it's still there. You can still have it. Now, don't misunderstand me. I do not mean to say that just because I say it and you believe me, And so suddenly you can be the life of the party, or you can be quiet while somebody else is being the life of the party, or you can sign up for graduate school. No. It takes work. And the work, of course, it's quite often psychotherapy. So if you're interested in psychotherapy, I suggest that you pursue it. If you'd like to talk to me about it, I do all my practice on the phone these days. You can go on my website, thelynnshow.com. That's thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. If you go up on thelynnshow.com, there's a place to email me if you're curious about having therapy on the phone. I wrote an article called Psychotherapy on the Go, which you can read at the website. Also, I wrote a book, which you could have access to on the website. But now, I'm going to tell you what I also do in this show. Besides trying to make this point in this way, I try and make this point in another way, by interviewing people who make their living or their life with an art. These are people who have managed to hold on to a very essential part of who they are. It's very difficult to make a living, not to mention make a life, of an art in our culture. So the people who do it, at least in the area of their work, they have, you can hear it when you listen to them. And today is no exception. Jeff Plunkett is so very much an actor. And he was also one of the lucky ones who had parents who wanted him to be who he is. And the end result is an extraordinary actor. And not only an extraordinary actor, who I hope, if you have not already seen him in the Florida Studio Theater production of The Columnist, you will run right down and get a ticket, because you shouldn't miss it. But not only is Jeff a really extraordinary actor, he's a thoughtful, intelligent, serious man who apparently did a lot of research on the character that he's playing in The Columnist, a real-life person, and the time in which this character lived. And we talk a lot about it in this interview, which is one of the reasons it's so interesting to me. So now, here, Jeff Plunkett. Okay, so I'm here with Jeff Plunkett in a rehearsal room at FST, and he is here starring in The Columnist at FST. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I've stolen him from a rehearsal, which...
I appreciate that, actually.
I do, too. Okay, so I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Yes.
And as an actor, I'm making the psychic leap that that's what you do. Is that correct?
I do, yes.
Okay, good. And I only ask one question.
Please.
How did it happen? How did it start? Not what was your first job, but what was the first moment in your life that it occurred to you that acting, stories, entertaining, maybe making people pay attention or laugh, any that became a part of your consciousness?
I became very young. I remember in second grade we were reading a story, and then there was a textbook had a play in it, and we just started reading that aloud, and there was just a certain joy I felt in trying to make these words on the page sound spontaneous. Next time.
Really? So second grade, seven?
Seven, I guess.
Eight?
Yeah.
Something like that? Seven. This is an interesting thing to say. That you spontaneously decided to make the words more interesting, more than just read them. Was that a direction from the teacher?
I always loved for language. My parents kind of instilled that in me.
How did they do that?
Just encouraging reading. You know, I lived in a small town growing up, and went to the library all the time, and there was a small grammar school, some small student-teacher ratio.
Uh-huh.
I thought I had good guidance and attention. And that love of literature then...
Stories.
Stories kind of developed into a storytelling love as well. And, you know, as you know, there's a very distinct difference between a novel and a play. A play is rather like the score of a symphony. can certainly read the notes, but it's not only until performance takes place that the life...
It's just laying there.
Just laying there, exactly.
Yeah. So at seven, you have a clear memory of seeing these words and thinking, I can do something with this.
Absolutely. I made the distinction very young that there was a difference between literature and playwriting.
That there was a difference between just reading the thing and then somehow becoming it or acting it, or
absolutely.
Is that what you mean?
Absolutely.
Right, okay. So here you are at seven in the second grade, and I'm assuming everybody is reading off this thing. Was it read aloud?
It was read aloud.
Mm-hmm. And
it's very informal.
Yeah,
really,
no.
It wasn't a seminal moment in my life. It just...
Oh, I think you're wrong, actually.
In retrospect, it was. But happening, it certainly had no great impact on me whatsoever, except that I just remember a distinct enjoyment of it.
Yeah, see, I think that is what makes it seminal, actually. I mean, you can ask, I don't know, everybody on the street what they remember about when they were seven, and most of them will not have any memories from the time they were seven.
It's traumatic. I broke my arm.
Did you? Oh, you mean what happened?
That's my first memory, though.
Is your broken arm?
What their first memory is.
Oh, is that?
Usually something traumatic.
Traumatic, of course. Okay, so at that moment when you're reading, did anyone comment on it? Or were you aware that you were doing something different than other people were doing?
My teacher just said, you seem to have a taking towards this. So she was very encouraging.
Yeah, all right. I think this was really a big deal, actually. I think this was very important.
You
know, not only that you found it inside of yourself, but immediately you got re-encouragement.
Absolutely.
For it. That's great. Okay, good. So
here's to our teachers,
Here's to our good teachers. Right.
Teachers, yeah.
Absolutely. So, and the other thing I want to say about that is what she did was really nice. She complimented you on it. No, that's not even right. She commented on the fact that it seemed to have meaning for you.
Exactly.
And she didn't put anybody else down by that.
Exactly.
Right. And it was perfect. Mm-hmm. Good for you, whoever you are.
Mrs. West.
Mrs. West. So, okay, so what is the next thing that happens that leads you in this path?
So I also enjoyed singing quite a bit. And my mother will deny this to this day. She really doesn't anymore. But when I was little with her, she would sing around the house. And she had a rich, alto, dense, loud voice. Mm-hmm. And I recall it was, I think the musical Hair was in like the top 10 on radio shows. And she loved those songs. I remember she was pregnant with my little brother, Chris.
And how old were you?
So I was 5 or 6. And so she'd be singing around the house, and I enjoyed that. And so I quickly enjoyed singing. So that was a lot about actors. Their kind of career begins with singing. And I have a blessing and a curse. I had chronic ear infections growing up, which I still am grappling with to this day. And because I was singing so much, my parents took me to a pediatrician who happened to know a woman who not only gave voice lessons, but ran this rather esteemed opera company on the New Jersey shore. And so at a young age, I think I was 13, I started studying with her.
Wow.
So we thought that perhaps learning how to sing correctly might
help your ears.
Strain my voice, my ears. So it was really...
Wow. Talk about...
A dark moment came in. Bright light, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I was singing small roles with her opera company then, at a young age, studying with her through high school then.
Okay, so you're already on stage.
Already on stage.
Yeah, you're already performing. You're already thinking of yourself as a performer.
I was. She was very pragmatic, and she insisted, actually, that I study something else when she sent me off to college. This is my voice teacher.
So
I did.
What did you study?
I studied psychology and biology, and I was on a pre-med track in undergraduate school.
Wow.
And I went to a small undergraduate school, which afforded me the opportunity to almost pick and choose the roles I wanted to play.
Because there
was a small, it wasn't even, when I was there, now it's a booming and growing theater department, but there wasn't even a theater department. It was just this wing
teacher?
Of the English department that put on 4 productions a year. And I was graced. They were wonderful years. We had a woman who's still there whose sets, I've yet to work on more beautiful sets, and this director who was legendary, who worked with Eric Bentley, who had done Bertolt Brecht's adaptation. So I just had this incredible cadre of talented support while I was pursuing something completely different. So my focus was split in college, and that was fine. I often tell young students that I think a good broad-based liberal arts education is really important to any artist, just because you have so much more to draw. You're exposed to science, and literature, and philosophy, and religion.
I think that's right. So you completed college. You got a degree in either psychology or biology, right? And did you have a minor in drama?
No,
you never even did that.
That was not even possible. I perhaps would have nowadays, but that was not even.
Okay, so you graduate. You've got a BA or something.
Yes, and I at that point I knew I probably didn't want to go to med school. And it was funny because I had even taken summer physics classes and things just to catch up.
You're a good boy.
Good boy. But in my senior year, I had auditioned for a lot of really premier graduate programs in acting. And right down the road from, I went to Bucknell University for undergraduate, and right down the road was Penn State University, which had an enormous theater program. And they had offered me a graduate fellowship, and it was the day after graduation that I called them and said, is that offer still on the table? And they said yes. So.
And you said yes.
I said yes. Mm-hmm. These were heady days of graduate school, too.
Ooh.
There was seemed to be a lot of money, and there were stipends. And
yeah, there was money around.
There was money around.
Yeah, right.
So
you were lucky.
Right. So it was... I lived in the nicest apartment I've ever lived in. I had a car, and those were heady days in graduate school. And so that was 3 years of conservatory training.
Well, did your family notice that you weren't going to be a doctor?
Yeah,
you were going to be an actor?
Completely supportive. I'm very fortunate that way. Not all families are, and I think every parent knows how fraught with difficulty this career path is. And if they don't, they're kidding themselves, because it is. I mean, 99% of actors aren't working at any given time in the union.
Right.
Not even the ones that aren't union. So, but I appreciate it. They, when in the balance of life, happiness over financial success, they seem to prefer happiness.
For you.
For me, which I'm very fortunate, and I'm continue to be grateful to them for that. And let me just mention, they are across the state right now, and they winter in Port St. Lucie. And I think my parents have missed maybe two shows I've been in my entire career. So
wow.
I imagine they'll be tracking their way over.
I'm sure that's right.
Lucky.
Yeah, you are definitely lucky. There's no question about it. You've had support in every place that you were.
Isn't that something?
Yes, it is something.
It is something.
I mean, you didn't get, what are you thinking, who do you think you are, what
absolutely.
Are you crazy, any of that, which is what most people who are going to try and make a living, certainly as an actor, my God,
right.
Get. So you had a pretty easy ride, and then, Penn State says, open arms, here, come and let us give you money and take care of you and study here, right? Okay. So you have these 3 years of this extraordinary conservatory experience.
Yeah, morning to night.
Morning to night.
Yeah.
Loved every minute.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right. You're in heaven. And then you graduate.
And I graduate. That's funny you put it that way. That was difficult to graduate. It was difficult to leave that incubus.
That doesn't sound strange to me.
Perhaps, Right. It was,
really, it's literally like leaving the womb.
It is leaving the womb, and leaving the womb without parents.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Nothing. You're sort of dumped out of the womb.
Right. And one thing about... picking a graduate program that's not so affiliated with a New York base or
Chicago. Any of those places.
So you really are a little left more to your own devices. That changed. I think my program that I went to has realized that, and other programs realize that they need to transition their actors a little better into the marketplace.
Yeah, that it's not just about training them, but it's about helping them get work.
They were not unclear about that. You did have classes in the business of being connect.
That's not the same thing.
Not the same thing as actually leading one into the next step.
Right, right.
So I did. I moved.
Or through. Having some kind of connection that way that you're feeding, that
right.
somebody's expecting you. Right, right,
right.
Okay, so you leave the hallowed halls, and you're standing there with your 2-3, right? Exactly. and you're in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Right? So?
So I lived close to New York. I was born up there, and then I was familiar with New York. So I made the move. I made 2 moves to New York. The first did not go that well. It was hard, and I was living far away from my job waiting tables, and was learning the subway system.
Where were you living?
I was living in Long Island City, which was a ghost town at that time.
Yeah.
Now everyone's living in Long Island City. But
or Brooklyn.
Yeah, or Brooklyn. But back then, not many people did. And lonely train rides. Another great thing about this business is the people that I went to school with are the people that continued to help me in my career. And that's what happened. I ended up kind of booking things through people I knew. And that has been the story of my life for the next 2 decades.
This is, of course, not an unusual story.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, for anything.
Yes,
I tell every student who's
right.
in their classmates, one reason not to bully is
the
person sitting next to you,
yes.
the CEO someday, absolutely.
Right.
Help you up the chain.
Right, or not.
Or not.
Right. Okay, so the first go-around in New York, did you get work?
I got work, yeah. Right out the bat. I was graced. And then that has its pluses and minuses. You get a false sense of how the business works, so... Yeah, I was working quite a bit in my youth, my early days. And then a dry spell came. It got really dark, and I tried to find some... I wasn't looking for other career paths. I just need to pay the rent, as everyone after does. And I was managing restaurants for quite a while. I started as a waiter, and I was managing. And by the time I was managing a rather famous restaurant called Orso, I was married to that job, and I realized I had completely lost track of my goals there. The money was extraordinary, but it was...
But the happiness was not.
Yeah, the happiness was not. It was time-consuming.
You'd switch the emphasis from the happiness to the finance.
I find it absolutely extraordinary, and here's my hat off to waiters, and every actor probably has to wait tables, and every waiter here in town... People go into restaurants and they lose their minds. They feel like they're in an emergency room and they'll come screaming up to you and say, my chicken's cold. I didn't lose your spleen. Well, I have to go back and warm this. There's just this incredible sense of urgency in restaurants that is...
and sense of entitlement.
Yes.
Right.
So I knew I didn't want to do that anymore. And I parlayed that into... I was working in hotels and I'm now at a New York tour guide. I have my own company giving tours of New York City, which is great because I get to call upon all the things I learned in school in terms of keeping 50 people entertained for anywhere from 8 hours to 5 days and trying to infuse excitement about, it's not too hard, about New York City, but bring people around and engaging them and speaking extemporaneously.
Spontaneous, a little improv here.
Yeah, a little improv, trying to throw a few jokes in there, keep the act fresh. So I enjoy it.
I could be wrong about this, but you get to choose your hours.
That's
right?
Absolutely right.
Right, you want to work, you don't want to work.
Extraordinary flexible.
Right.
Flexible. So
right.
I can, what I've done is I've put that business on hold for 4 months and I'm just keeping in touch with clients and booking when I'm getting back in town. So this is
so for 4 months.
Nicely.
Is that because you're working?
We're here for 4 months.
You're here for 4 months.
Yeah.
This is running for 4 months.
We're running, I think, through the 7th. We have an option to extend through the 14th, and then perhaps the 28th of April.
Of April.
Yeah. So many wonderful things have happened at this theater, and I am so fortunate to have a long history with this theater.
Talk about that.
I worked here in 1996. When they were they weren't young. They were kind of
no, they weren't young.
Midlife.
You were young.
Yeah, they were kind of starry. I think Richard came in 1980, if I'm not mistaken.
I think that's right.
So they were kind of like in their middle phase. phase of their development. The year I came, this building that we're sitting in the Cabaret building, the first Cabaret building now. This had just opened in 1996. And so they had doubled their physical plant. And then I was not here for a number of years, and I came back.
Well, wait a minute. What did you do in 96? What were you?
Two plays back to back. I did a play called The God of Isaac and a play, Marivaux, kind of comedy, commedia dell'arte piece called The Game of Love and Chance, which we call The Gamble of Love.
Mm-hmm. I actually think I saw that.
Good heavens. Wow. So I was away for a while, and we kind of lost touch with one another. And then in 2007, I came back, and they had bought this office space next door, and they had purchased the old movie theater across the street.
That used to, no, it wasn't a movie theater. It was Theater West.
When I was, I think it originally opened as a movie house, and it was Theater Works.
I mean Theater Works. Theater West is something in Los Angeles.
Right.
Theater Works.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they had just purchased that, and were running a second kind of
alternative season.
So they had three theaters running.
So what did you do in 2007?
I did a play called Permanent Collection, which was about the, loosely based on the Gibbons collection, the Barnes collection in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. I didn't see it.
Yeah. And then almost kind of every year, every other year since then, I've been lucky to be back here. It is like a wonderful family. You know, a town this size probably can't support two repertory companies, but they are so loyal here to bringing actors back, and they, without actually having a company,
once you have shown them that you can do what they're asking you to do, they want to use you.
They're remarkably loyal that way.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah. It's wonderful. Okay, so do you remember? Well, let me ask it another way. Aside from FST, is there other work you want to talk about?
Yes, I want to talk about the loss of a theater company. Very sad. That was almost at the birth of a wonderful space in Greenwich Village called Manhattan Theater Source, which was not only a black box theater, but it was a place for artists to go and for writers to go and write, and there was a library to go and get scripts, and there was a voiceover booth to work on your demo tape, and there was a place called Digital Source where friends of mine edited films and worked on movies, and it was in this townhouse of a building on McDougal Street, and they had a 12-year run that Broadway shows and off-Broadway shows came out of that crucible, if you will, and I did maybe 15 plays. It was my playground, and that's something else I tell students, that find yourself a playground. It's not always important that you be making money, but it is always important that you're
working,
experimenting, and stretching, and exercising. And some people do that through class, which is great. That was my classroom. It was a great place where I premiered plays, and we did some classics as well, and some really fun directorial choices, and I feel a part of that community of thousands of artists too.
Yeah, that's the other piece I was going to say, is that you belong to something then.
Absolutely.
The sense of belonging, that's the parents thing.
Yes,
know?
Right.
Yeah, the siblings, the family, really, right?
I think a sense of community when you're an artist is so important, because it's fraught with so much rejection. So to have those people cheerleading you on all along the way, throughout your entire lifetime, is really important.
That is what family does.
Absolutely.
And I talk a lot about how difficult it is to make a living or a life within art. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways to survive is to do just what you're talking about, is to create a family in which you are by which you are supported.
Right, the psychic encouragement. Is
exactly.
As important.
Right, so you're not taken out there by yourself. So what happened?
They lost their lease. So, you know, the Village is the heart of New York University, which is now the largest property owner on the island of Manhattan. And that has its perks. It's a wonderful university, and it's the one of the reasons why the village is always infused with culture, art, bright minds. But the downside is, and this is a problem I think of universities all across the country, is where does the line stop of how large an institution do we want to become, and are we creating things to build the program or just to start getting more financial resources to feed yesterday's debts? So I'm not quite sure what's going on with NYU. There's a lot of community activism going on, but they seem to have bought the whole block, this building.
They said, we want that, and that was it?
It's very hard to go up against. And there's community forums. I've watched, you know, Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker live down there, and they're very active in trying to keep the community, which is as vital as the institutions right. that are in a part of it. So it was a sad loss, and I'm here. I did the last show there. It was this time last year, and I'm welling up a bit thinking about the loss of that space. The organization is committed to
finding another space.
Not so much keep another space, but produce other various venues, maintain a producing organization. It's hard to do without a home.
No, absolutely. I was going to ask: is there a membership? I mean, do you know what I mean? I mean, is there anything holding it together?
Entirely voluntary run organization. And they used to call them the tribe, and I still get emails to the tribe. I think some of our great emerging playwrights are coming out of that. The last play I did was by this amazingly gifted author named Mac Rogers, who is the darling of the off-Broadway theater scene right now. He just won an armful of awards last year for a trilogy of plays that he developed. Good friend of mine named Montserrat Mendez, who is not only a playwright but an actor and a screenplay author and a television pilot author who's written episodes for Desperate Housewives.
So oh dear.
There are just amazing people there. There's an actor in Django Unchained right now who I worked with. He's also in Copper, a wonderful actor named Atto Asando. Was part of that company.
So, but when you call it a company, it suggests it has some kind of organizational
structure. We thought
it
did, and it was very loosey-goosey. You know, there's nothing certainly...
Yeah, but the problem, of course, with that is that once the house is gone, whatever the thing that was actually holding everybody together is gone. That's what the point I'm making.
That's what's heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
We're waiting to see what
right.
happens
it, right. Because there isn't anything else. Everybody then
right.
is on their own. Right. Okay.
These have been lean years for all of us, as we all know.
Yeah,
And you know, no one felt the foreclosure debacle more than Floridians did. But I think I think we felt that too. I think we were a part of that. You know, they had a monthly nut that they just couldn't carry any longer as rents went up.
Right.
So, nothing sadder than it.
No, truly, no. And of course, this isn't going to come as shocking to anyone. When the money gets tight, the first things to go are the arts.
And it's remarkable.
It's remarkable. It's the last thing we can afford to lose and the first thing that goes. But
succinctly put.
This is where we live.
Right.
We live in this Philistine place.
And, yeah. You know, through the country, because I'm engaged with people from Paris and people from the UK quite often. I have this group of really bright students from Oxfordshire who come every year, and they remind me that Churchill's, you know, they wanted to cut back on the arts during World War II, and Churchill's quote was, what are we fighting for?
Yeah, wow.
So while people were rationing eggs and bacon, they were holding the London Symphony Orchestra was still going on.
Right,
you know,
right. I love the Brits.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
What are we fighting?
We lost a lot when we left there.
Yeah, right.
they sent all the Puritans over here.
Bleak.
Yes, right. What?
Black
sing?
Horse.
What dance? What? Plant. Okay. So that's a serious blow to you, and on the heels of that, you find, you know, this opens back up for you.
Yes.
Right?
Of course.
Right. Any future plans? Anything you want to talk about?
I don't at the moment.
Well, you don't need to, because you got 4 months of work.
Yeah, and let me tell you, this is a thrilling play.
Yes, and please talk to me about the play.
Number one, we're running longer than they got to a Manhattan Theater Club, so, and it's a good play, and I didn't even realize it, how good it was, until we started slogging through it. There's a difficulty of this play. This man, Joseph Alsop, who I had heard of, but I didn't know nothing about, and that's astounding, because as I read many books about him and the articles by him, he was swinging around the upper circles of not only political life, but social circles. He created the Georgetown set. His article was one of the most syndicated articles in newspaper history. And not only was he a reporter, but he was a commentator, and he finessed our way into World War II. He finessed our way into the Vietnam conflict. He was not only connected through work, but through lineage. He was cousins with Eleanor Roosevelt and distant cousins with Franklin Roosevelt. His granduncle was President Theodore Roosevelt.
I recently listened to an audiobook of a Gore Vidal novel.
Gore Vidal satirized him.
Yes,
yeah, right,
in this novel.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's amazing.
Right.
It's a great novel.
It's a good novel. Hey, we're not friendly, clearly.
No,
not a loving portrait.
No.
And he was not a loving man. That's the great challenge about this, is by all accounts, he was extraordinarily charming and ebullient and the life of the party, and at the same time, he could be a bully
and
obnoxious and vindictive and dark and knew that and used those as weapons, and on a dime could turn that into charm again. So he kept himself in the center of things. So that's fascinating on that level. It's fascinating speaking with you, a reporter, someone who's reporting events, because this was the heyday of print media. I mean, New York itself had 12 daily newspapers, and people got their information by coming home at night and reading the newspaper, and there wasn't so much telegenic media and sound bites. This was deep analysis, long commentary, and criticism.
And so a lot of responsibility.
Extraordinary responsibility for the press, for what the press is mandated to do, which is to be the watchdog of the government in this country.
And you know, something you said that I really I'm interested in from the point of view of the actor, that that he could be charming, he could also be brutal, and that he could go back and forth between them, and that he understood his capacity for brutality and didn't judge it, in fact, liked it, thought of it as one part of him that he could really use, right?
Absolutely.
That's an interesting psychological profile.
Deep, dark, and self-aware man.
Yes. And I imagine, because it's not that common, it would be a little difficult to play.
What I think is difficult to play, and the challenge is to get that sense of, because the playwright really concentrates on those. And we talked about this, how every scene is really a play in and of itself, although this happens kind of chronologically. It's not linear. Every scene is this enormous moment through Kennedy's assassination, through his dealings with LBJ, through their further falling into the quagmire of Vietnam, and his intractability, his unable or an unwillingness to change his positions about America's role in the future going forward. And in terms of, it's wonderful being in this community where there is a generation of people who went through that. Where there was this left, there was isolationist right that didn't want involvement in World War II. There was more a left party that wanted, that saw America's role taking over from the British Empire. And then the rise of what he calls the isolationist left, which kind of outflanked him, and all of a sudden he saw himself on the
wrong side of history, right.
And absolutely right, the wrong side. And what that must have been to a man who had developed that ego and who had been so used to having that, wielding that power.
Actually, you know, this makes me think of Dick Cheney and that amazing debacle the night that Obama gets elected. And he comes on and says, no, he hasn't.
Right.
You know.
Yes. There is, and that, the painfulness of that.
Yes.
Because I think that's the tragedy of these great men who find a voice and have worked decades to create that voice, and all of a sudden that voice is out of step with them.
Well, and have had the power to make things happen according to their vision.
Right.
And they miss it. They miss the moment when either their vision is so out of step with history, or they're just plain wrong. You know, they miss it.
Yes.
And then they are, yeah. So does that happen in the play?
I don't want to tip the play.
Don't tip the play. Never mind. Come and see it. Come and see how Jeff pulls this off. I mean, you know. Joe may not have been able to, but Jeff will.
I will say that. It's funny you bring that up about Cheney and other people. The last era, as we approach the next, is there are missed opportunities to be elder states people.
Yes.
I think we're missing that in this generation. You know,
well, really, but I think I could be all wrong about this, but I think that there's a huge difference between elder statesmen and I'm going to get it the way I want it.
Right.
That kind of, you called them great men. I would use a different word, powerful men.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, I think great actually goes with statesmen.
Mm, yes.
And then you're talking here about people who have the capacity to be extraordinarily powerful,
right,
but they're not great.
Right.
Because great allows for you to make the move.
Yes.
To see beyond your own limited vision.
I think people can move from one of those states to another. I think this character was a great man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what is so remarkable about that is I can talk about him and so few people know who I'm talking about.
I know.
And we've moved into a different kind of media. We get our news from people who have Q ratings, I guess they're called, or cuteness ratings.
I don't know what that is.
There's a kind of likability factor that our newscasters have to stay on the air. So the age of television really changed not only the way we get the news, but the way we write the news and the people who tell us the news.
And forgive me, this is probably so not PC, but that's how we got George Bush. He got elected because people wanted to have a beer with him.
That was what was said, right?
Right.
That's often the phrase that's used now.
Yep, yeah. Exactly, right.
Right.
And, you know, really, that...
And news takes time, you know, and there's... I just find it remarkable that now we have a 24-hour news cycle that is so frenzied all the time that people are always rushing to the next commercial break. And the phrase we hear all the time on cable news is, I'm sorry, I don't have time now. And my thought is, really? You have 24 hours of news running.
Right.
Why don't you have the time?
That's right. And so, what did you think you were there for?
Right. So to read this man's columns...
Right, and to know that other people were reading them.
Absolutely.
Right.
When it was a reading culture, and this is where the interview began, you know, that's how I love to get my information, is reading. Because it gives you time we live in a complicated world, and our news does not reflect that. Our news reflects sound bites.
You know, I'm listening to A Team of Rivals. It's the book about Lincoln.
I read it last
Did you?
Time I was here, as a matter of fact.
Amazing. So I'm only halfway through. But the thing that was so startling to me, well, not the thing, everything in it was startling to me. I was having sympathy for you so much I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that how people got their information then was by listening to these people speak.
Absolutely.
They could sit for 3 hours and listen to... You know, Lincoln or Douglas or...
Straining to listen to
Straining,
them.
Right. And, right. And, you know, and to be moved by their erudition, by the metaphors they chose to use,
A house
where
divided
is that?
Against itself
cannot
stand is what thrust Lincoln into the presidency.
Right.
It was his rhetoric.
Right.
It was his soaring rhetoric.
Right.
And that, this play is full of that. This play that.
Well, that generation was still literate. I mean, you know, the Lincoln's generation, they didn't have newspapers, so they got it from sitting there and listening, but they were listening to the words.
Right.
You know, he was writing the words. People were, we're not doing that anymore.
Right.
We're just not.
And not to put it too fine a point on this, but, you know, there's also pitfalls of these eras. I mean, so this play deals with that, that women were subjugated and not treated well and did not have an equal voice and were arm candy and hostesses, and their opinions were not taken seriously, and so the radical shift of the 60s where women started, there's a whole thing about women's clothing, you know, that a dress went above the knee. That's fascinating too. So you can look at these times and say how wonderful it was, and that is not the point. You know, the point is that there are great things to pick at it.
Yes, right.
In history.
Right. And this play is a snapshot of not only this man's life, but the world in which he lived, the world he inhabited. Is that not correct?
A really full one.
Yeah.
Remarkably full one.
Yay. I love stuff like this,
yeah.
As you may be able to tell.
The manners and what was expected of people and how people dealt with one another and how people could argue and not be hate-filled.
Yes, right.
That, you know, the discourse was challenging, and it was as raucous as could be, and there were fist fights sometimes, but there was a
civility.
I mean, civility is the word. I was going to say gentleness, but that was not peaceful. There was a civility.
Yeah, right. And in that time, gentlemanness would have been appropriate. That would have been the appropriate way to talk.
And I think people had the wisdom, and perhaps that's my character's flaw, that he lacks this later in life, but they were big enough to learn from one another.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so the other question that I ask is, having given a life to the art of acting, is there anything you would want to say about it?
It's such a joy. I mean, you don't get to do it as much as you would want sometimes, usually, sometimes not. But whenever you have the opportunity, it's I've learned about music, and I've learned about history, and I've learned about art, and I've learned about sports, and I've learned about how to play the violin, and I've learned about every play has these unique, as we mentioned, windows and specific challenges, dialects. And it's so easy to call, you know, people say, oh, it's a holy experience, and it is the church. And I put perspective on it. You know, this is a play, and we're playing. But it is important because we play together, you know. So the community that comes to support this is as more important than anything we're doing up there, because we're having this shared experience. The rehearsals are a joy because you're meeting people that become your lifelong friends, and then you come back together sometimes, which is even more remarkable. And you learn about yourself, and then you, if a place like this exists where they're committed to bringing people back, you have these second homes all across the country. You know, so lovely here. Good heavens! And every time I get back here, I think, oh, this is. Looking for a place, maybe, or keeping your eye out on the for sale signs. Because I get that asked a lot as a tour guide in New York. People often ask, do you ever see yourself living any other place? And my answer is absolutely. You know, I'm lucky enough to leave New York
in the
often
storm.
Enough right, that I don't, it doesn't drive me insane. Because I think it can, you know, it's a fast paced city to constantly be in. But that's another great thing about the queer. It just brings you to great places in the world where you meet new people and just create new homes for yourself.
It's a good place to stop.
Okay.
And we would be happy to have you, Jeff.
I appreciate that. We'll keep looking together.
Thank you, Jeff.
It was so nice. Thank you.
So you hear in Jeff what I talked about at the beginning, that he is a person who was encouraged from the very beginning to accept, enjoy, and honor who he is. And so at every turn, he was able to ask himself, is this what I want? Do I like this? Does this fit me? You can even hear it in the end when he's talking about where he might like to live. He's always able to ask the question, is this me? And in the end, that is what I believe makes the difference between a satisfying and an unsatisfying life. So as we are rapidly running out of time in this show, I need to thank the amazing Josh Hackney, who rides to the rescue and saves me from every technological conundrum and screw-up that I make and run into. If you have technological needs, you want Josh, and you can get him like you can get me at my website, thelinshow.com. Remember not to leave the E out of Lynn. And as always, I hope that you got something you can use from this show, something that inspired you to ask the question, who am I? Am I myself? Or something that amused you or interested you. Maybe you, like me, were interested in all that information about the life and times of Joseph Alsop. In any case, I hope you got something that's going to bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I, as always, hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray, always in my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, Belle, but I still got some tang. So